Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello and welcome to Project Zion, the Restoration Caffeinated. Grounds for Peace is a new international podcast that comes from the work of peaceprojects.eu. In this series, we are asking, what are the grounds, you might say the foundations, for a new peaceful humanity? I am your host, Joey Williams, member of the Community of Christ European Peace and Justice Team and Mission Center President for the Western Europe Mission Center. According to Steve Veazey, President of Community of Christ, no matter where we start from as individuals, our calling, our purpose as a human species is to be a peaceful humanity. The phrase peaceful humanity is another way of saying Zion, God's vision or dream for the world. Today, our guests are Ryan and Georgia Commons, who have just done a webinar for us on nonviolence and what we eat. In their webinar session, they helped answer the question, can peace begin on our plates? And I have to say, they did a great job. Georgia has a love for literature and has recently finished a 4-year degree in English literature. She is now pursuing her master's. Ryan graduated with a degree in theology and religious studies and soon will be starting a new job teaching philosophy and religion. Both Georgia and Ryan have been living a plant-based lifestyle for 4 years. So Georgia and Ryan, welcome. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having us, Jerry.
Yeah.
Can you tell us just a little bit about yourselves? I gave a little talk about your education, but tell us where you're from and where you're living now and what you're doing.
I'm Georgia, and I'm from England, from the north of England, and I had never lived outside of there, not really outside of specifically Cheshire, where I grew up either, until I met this guy. And then suddenly, well, I don't know, we moved to Cambridge, we studied there, moved around loads of places there, and then moved to London more recently, which was a very big culture shock for me at first. I remember the first time that I went on the trains to London with Ryan, and I got off the train and it was like just huge. And I was like, I feel like I'm in another country. Like, this is just insane. Like, why do you need a shopping center in a train station? Like, you don't need that. That's just insane and ridiculous.
Yeah, London's huge.
Yeah, compared to where I grew up anyway.
So I come originally from Kent in the southeast of England. When I grew up, I lived in various places, including Australia and North Wales. I met Georgia, we got married, we moved to Cambridge. I did a degree in theology and religious studies at the University of Cambridge, followed by a postgraduate teacher training qualification, which has been very bizarre during the lockdown because I haven't actually been physically in schools, but that's still been a wonderful experience. And now we recently moved to London, as Georgia said, and I'm starting a new job in a week's time.
Wonderful. Thank you, guys. So you recently did a webinar for us, and the topic of the webinar was nonviolence and what we eat. And you answered this question, can peace begin on our plates? And I actually want to start kind of at the end of that webinar, because I asked you a question and I mentioned that there were people who are always looking for rules, right? In what they eat and what they put on their plates. Can I eat this or can I not eat that? In becoming a vegan or a vegetarian, you know, is this all a rule-based thing? Is it just things that you should or shouldn't eat? Or is it a little more principle-based? And I really liked it because you gave us 5 different principles. So if you don't mind, would you mention what those 5 principles are in heading towards a vegan or a vegetarian lifestyle?
Sure. So the first thing to say is that I would also encourage people to reflect on their own principles and come up with their own list of what their values are and what guides their food choices. But these are my 5 principles. that have helped me to move in that direction. So the first is knowledge and education. This empowers you to make informed choices. So abuse and exploitation in our food system goes unchecked because so many people are not aware of where their food is coming from or what's been involved in actually bringing it to their table. So the first principle is knowledge. I think the solution is about education and becoming informed about where your food is coming from. The second principle is compassion, because I think when you know about the suffering that animals experience on factory farms and the abuse and the exploitation of slaughterhouse workers, the risks that factory farms pose to our public health, compassion is then the sort of motivating force that guides you to make those changes to try and reduce some of that suffering as far as you can through your food choices. The third principle for me is courage, because food is such a large part of our lives, part of our culture, and it's so easy to fall into habits that we've grown up with from when we were a child that then become really deeply entrenched. And it takes courage to look honestly at what we're eating, the reality of it, the impact that our food choices make, and then to make those changes where necessary. The fourth one for me is self-care. And I think this is important because it helps to sustain the changes that we make. So I try to make food choices that help me to support my physical and my mental well-being. This is important in its own right because we're all worth taking care of, but it also means you're less likely to burn out or give up on the changes that you make and to feel disheartened. And then finally, for me, an important principle is citizenship. So I think that peace can begin on my plate, but it shouldn't end there. So citizenship is this idea of taking what you've learned and sharing it with others, because one individual's food choice is not going to change the entire food system. It requires kind of collective action, which makes it important for us to speak to others, to raise awareness, and even to raise these issues with public officials and things like that.
Great. So those are knowledge, compassion, courage, self-care, and citizenship. Let's go back to knowledge. Tell me, how do we gain this knowledge? Where are some sources where people can gain more knowledge?
So there's an abundance of information out there, an abundance of sources that people can turn to find knowledge about their food and where it comes from. Even a simple sort of Google search will pull up an awful lot of information. There's several documentaries as well. Obviously, it's important always to think critically about the quality and of the research that's gone into them. Also, I would say looking at food labels can be helpful, because often we're not aware of how prevalent animal products are in our society and throughout our food system. So looking at some of the products that we consume on a daily basis, looking at the back of the labels and actually seeing how many things milk powder, for instance, is included in, things that you wouldn't suspect. So that's a starting point, but it's not an ending point. It's a lifelong journey.
Yeah, great. And in the webinar, you talked about Food Inc., and that was one of my first ones too. I think, I don't know when that came out, but I remember seeing it at a 2008 film festival in Columbia, Missouri, at the University of Missouri. And I remember how impactful that was for me, kind of on my journey of what's on our plates. And you mentioned that in the webinar as well, as kind of a starting point where you saw that film and that documentary and thought, whoa, you know, what's going on and how are we treating the animals that we are putting on our plates?
Absolutely. It's very impactful. In the UK as well, there is a documentary film called Land of Hope and Glory, which just consists of footage that has just been taken from slaughterhouses. And it's just a compilation of that footage. It's hard hitting, so it may not be for everybody. But certainly if you want to really kind of get to grips with where your food is coming from, that's another thing to check out.
I think as well, even if you don't feel, you know, like sort of quite prepared to, you know, watch graphic slaughterhouse footage and to, you know, to see the kind of conditions that are on factory farming, I think you can almost sort of do it by taking a more hypothetical approach to it. You know, that was kind of my experience with it anyway. I mean, I mentioned in the webinar that I watched a speech by Gary Yourofsky, and I, you know, he's a controversial guy, and I definitely don't agree with maybe even a lot that he's done or said, but, you know, that speech definitely made an impact on me. And I didn't watch any kind of footage of animals being abused or slaughtered. You know, that speech just kind of made me question, like, you know, what would a good slaughter look like? You know what I mean? Like this kind of idea of you can show me all the footage in the world of the most horrendous animal abuse out there. And, you know, something that we realized a lot when we were doing street activism and talking to people on the street is they would say, well, you know, they'd see the footage and they'd say, well, this is just some bad farms. But I think then we would often kind of respond with a question to that, didn't we? Of, you know, well, what would it look like if it was being done good there? Like, how do you compassionately kill? How do you slaughter an animal in a way that is palatable, you know, and that would be okay to be seen on a footage and that wouldn't make us kind of have this like, oh, no, that's horrible. I don't want to see that. You know, what would nonviolent slaughter look like? You know, even if the end goal is for food, what would it actually look like? And I think that can be a good question to ask.
Yeah, and that compassion is the second principle that you've mentioned. So both of you have kind of given these brain type of answers that it's about based on the knowledge or based on asking a question, a hypothetical question. What about experience? What about the emotions that are involved in that? Or do you want to talk a little more about the compassionate side?
Absolutely. I think that especially in our modern industrialized world, where people are often very disconnected from nature and from animals, and we often don't have as many of the same experiences growing up as maybe people would have done 50 or 100 years ago. And sometimes it's quite difficult to empathize with an animal that looks so different. So I think developing that compassion involves learning more about the animals. What do we know about the emotions that animals experience? And that to me was very eye-opening, realizing that animals that look so different, and I've never, you know, you can't have a conversation with them, and yet they still experience pleasure, pain, and often much more complex emotions than that.
Yeah.
Is a foundation for empathy.
I've even seen these like kind of cut out cows that people take around, and then they have like these rubber udders the kids can play with, because kids in cities especially have maybe never seen a cow, never even gotten out of their city. Yeah. And actually touched physically a cow to have any empathy at all in what it is that eventually might be on their plates. Georgia, did you have anything to add to that?
I think with me, one of the key moments, I mean, I already had the compassion for the animals by this point, but I think that a point where it became undeniable for me was when we went to our first slaughterhouse vigil, because that was just such an incredibly, you know, powerful kind of moment emotionally. It was so draining. Like, we both came back just, I don't know, not even crying. We were just like, just so empty, you know, like we were just like, how can there be that much pain and cruelty just on one truck in one small little town in England, you know? And then when you think of the scale that this is actually on, it was just kind of such a hard-hitting kind of moment for us, because when you're at these vigils, you can't help but connect with the animals that you're looking into the eyes of. I mean, you know, the eyes are a window into the soul, aren't they? You know, we like to say and stuff. And when you're face to face with a young chick that is about to be taken to slaughter, you know, you can argue back and forth about whether we're right in saying that they know or that they have an understanding or anything at all like that. But I definitely felt when I was there that they were some of the saddest eyes I had ever seen. And maybe I was reading too much emotion into it, but I really connected with the chickens in that truck. And it was honestly one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen, was to then have the truck drive off and then come back out empty. It was absolutely soul destroying. I'll be honest, it was horrendous. And so I think for me, that was when the compassion element became, you know, solidified, was because I was face to face with it. Before then, it was like a hypothetical thing, the knowledge element, like I was saying. But in that moment, I was face to face. You know, I could smell them, I could see them.
Yeah, yeah, and you were describing in the webinar that these vigils are pretty much planned activities, even with the slaughterhouses, that they inform the slaughterhouses that many people are going to show up. And they're going to stop the trucks as they go into the slaughterhouse or the place where they're going to be killed. And then it's kind of a moment to have a vigil, to have a moment of silence or a moment of appreciation of their lives before they then go on in there. Is there any more you want to add to that experience?
I think for me specifically, I always considered it, I think I mentioned in the webinar, I considered it my way of getting to pay a bit of final respect to the animal. Because, I mean, yeah, I've seen the footage from slaughterhouses. A lot of the time, at least, they're not given that kind of respect in their final moments. You know, just kind of being able to take that moment and to look them in the eye and see them as an individual. Okay, not a human, and maybe not in any way comparable to a human, but an individual nonetheless that has a preference for life and that has experienced some range of emotions and mental, you know, capacity and things. And that was, yeah, very powerful. And I know that, you know, sometimes we had, you know, disagreements with, you know, the slaughterhouses or the truck drivers. I remember one time they'd pulled up for the 2 minute sort of silence thing, but he was playing loud, like sort of music, kind of like dance music, really loud on the radio. And that really, you know, it really annoyed me and upset me. And I remember, like, I went to him and I was like, can you turn that off, please? Like, we're trying to have just like a last little bit of respect for these animals. And I was like, you know, I was quite like irritated by him in the time. But then as I took a step back, I was like, I mean, of course he's not going to do that, because this man transports thousands of chickens a day. If he gave every single chicken individual attention, he wouldn't get paid. He wouldn't get any job. He'd be filled with PTSD and horror, because it's horrible.
For many of the workers in slaughterhouses, that desensitization is a coping mechanism, because when you allow yourself to feel that compassion, that empathy, there's no way psychologically that you can continue to do what slaughterhouse workers are required to do. It requires that desensitization and that disconnection from seeing the animal as a living, sentient, conscious being.
Yeah, and I mean, I can attest to that, because I've got lots of family members that have worked in the industry, you know, as a butcher or in an actual slaughterhouse abattoir. And, you know, they're not vegan or vegetarian or anything, but they all acknowledge that when they first went in there, it was horrible. And they were really, really disturbed by, you know, the dyed animals or the big, you know, chunks of meat hanging up in the butchers. So I think this is something that I don't think that we should shy away from, you know, talking about, because it's important both for the animals and the workers. I don't think it's fair to expect people to desensitize themselves in that way to something like that.
Yeah, how interesting, Ryan, you just talked about desensitization. And so how it's necessary in this type of environment to do that, to be able to continue to do that type of job. And yet we've just mentioned doing a vigil could be a way to sensitize ourselves, to become more compassionate as we look at this topic and what it means for us emotionally, but also to see and really experience what these animals are going through. The next step in your principles is courage. And so could you tell about courage and how maybe it's been difficult for you with either family members or out there in the world to have courage in your principled approach to veganism?
I think courage was most important in the very earliest stages of my journey, when I was trying to decide whether to become vegetarian, actually. So I didn't go vegetarian straight away. When I was 14, I saw a documentary. I spoke about it a bit in the webinar, but I watched a documentary that made me think a lot about meat and the food industry, the animal agriculture industry. But I didn't go vegetarian straight away. And part of the reason was that my family's culture was very, not just heavily based around animal products in our diet, but almost sort of ridiculed or poked gentle fun at sort of the idea of vegetarianism. And so the thought of kind of standing up and saying, no, I'm going to be a vegetarian, against that kind of social pressure was very scary in a way. And so it did take a lot of courage to actually make that decision and say, no, I think this is wrong, and I'm not going to be a part of eating meat anymore. And then the steps along the way, in a way, I find each step becomes easier. And it's easy, your conviction grows. The more that you find yourself articulating to others why you're doing what you're doing, the more the strength of your own conviction grows. And then the courage is still required, but it's not as scary anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a difference in our personality, isn't it, as well? Because I think you're smiling, because I think you know where I'm going with this. is just that we always joke and say I'm a very all or nothing person. You know, if I sort of learn something or start to like resonate with something, I'm like, that's it, I'm doing that, you know. And I think that that's kind of what happened with me and veganism. So I honestly, like, you know, I understand it takes a lot of courage for many people, but I never felt like it took a lot of courage from me. Like, I remember I used to feel like such an imposter when people would say to me like, oh, but it must be really hard for you to have gone like vegan or whatever. And I was always like, no, like, I don't know. It was just, I think because I quite enjoyed it in a way. I'm kind of that person. I was like, yeah, I get to be that kind of like spicy, irritating person that gets to be like, oh, I don't eat that. not from a place of thinking that I was better than other people, but I always enjoyed being different and contrary, you know, and kind of different and going against society in that way.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing from both of you is that it really seems to be a question about identity. And Ryan, it seems that for you, it took some steps for it to really integrate itself into a part of your identity. And that required some courage. And it sounds like you, Georgia, your courage comes at the beginning, that you kind of claim this new identity and then carry it already with courage. So mm-hmm. I think it might be a question about identity and how easy it is once you've decided this is who I am, the world should accept me as I am, and then you have that identity and you can continue to move forward in that way. Let's talk a little bit about self-care. Because you said we don't want to get burnt out, you know, and so that's a really important principle to have self-care. What are some ways that you guys have both taken care of yourselves on your journey of veganism?
I think the main one for me was whenever we very quickly learned that whenever we'd gone to a vigil, when we come back, we have to watch happy animal videos. which maybe sounds quite childish, but literally we would go and see, like, you know, the chickens outside the slaughterhouse and then come back and look up funny chicken videos or cute chicken videos and have like some yummy vegan snacks and stuff, like biscuits and things, which maybe isn't the healthiest form of self-care, but it was just kind of like, you know, letting off steam after such a heavy emotionally charged kind of day.
I would second that. And also, in addition to that, I think it's important not to be overly restrictive with the way that you eat, especially if you decide to go fully vegan. You're already cutting out certain food groups which form a very large part of the standard Western diet. Some people then are tempted to go even further and maybe cut out lots of other foods as well and follow an even more restrictive diet. And I'm not saying that that is never a good idea, because people might have specific medical conditions or nutritional needs or something like that. But generally speaking, I've found from other people that I've seen and spoken with that can often be a recipe for both becoming mentally fatigued as it becomes increasingly difficult to find food that you can eat, but also you can run into nutritional difficulties as well when you're severely restricting the foods that you eat. So I'd say absolutely you can eat a wide variety of plant-based foods and eat them in abundance.
It's that outside perspective of someone else that sometimes can be a real put down as you're trying to make changes to your diet. And so you tell someone all of a sudden you're vegetarian or you're vegan or you're a pescatarian. And if they see you eat a piece of chicken when you say you're pescatarian, all of a sudden it's like you've done everything wrong and you can't go back now. I saw you eat a piece of chicken, so now you just need to eat chicken. I know that people have, maybe this goes back to that courage question, but I think it's also a matter of self-care to be aware that people mm-hmm. are probably going to really have a critical eye, especially people who are not looking at their own diet or what's on their plates, but are looking at what you've just said that you are, and then they want to either poke holes or they want to look at that and say, oh, he doesn't or she doesn't really follow that diet completely.
Yeah. And I think as well, a big thing that I'm sort of passionate about, if you like, within sort of vegan and plant-based eating, is I really dislike how it's come to be associated with kind of a diet and weight loss and, you know, and all these kind of things, because I think it can so quickly turn toxic. an example of this in particular that I'm thinking of is when I was doing my undergraduate degree, they offered, you know, I was really grateful for it. They offered vegan options in the canteen. But one thing I noticed was that the vegan option, if I was getting a sandwich, say, it was always labeled as, oh, under 300 calories or, you know, Weight Watchers friendly and things like this. And I think, like most people, you know, I've had issues in the past with the way I look and feel about myself. And, you know, it's not good or healthy, I think, to be equating veganism or vegetarian or anything just solely with a kind of diet culture, you know. And I really dislike the fact it's come to be associated with that. Like, I don't avoid meat because I want to lose weight. So if I'm buying lunch while I'm out, I don't want to have a kind of calorie count, you know, shoved down my throat. And I think that that can be an issue if there's not the kind of self-care element within veganism, because it's just common out there for it to be kind of put across in that way to you.
Yeah. And what we eat and what we actually can put on our plates, maybe the new stereotype. People are being very critical about what other people are putting on their plates. And Ryan, you talked in the webinar about, you know, the Western diet. And obviously there's a market that plays to that diet, greasier foods, animal-based foods. Then people with more money or more economic possibilities might then be able to live a more plant-based diet because they have more variety, but it's going to be costly. Yeah. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, definitely. Sorry. I'm really like passionate about all the whole sort of class element in veganism and plant-based diets. Like, you know, I mean, you can go and get like, you know, fish and chips for like £5 here. But if you were to go and get like, you know, fruits and vegetables and beans and things or tofu, it's a lot more expensive. And that is so wrong, because factory farm cheap meat is just so much more readily available and cheaper and more accessible. And then it's actually one thing that I find quite irritating about a lot of the vegan activism that is currently being done as well. It kind of places this burden on, you know, you need to avoid this and you need to do that, without recognizing the fact that you're placing the burden on some of the most vulnerable in our society that aren't going to be able to afford to do that under the kind of current structure of things. Organic free range meat is like 2 or 3 times the price of, you know, factory farmed meat and stuff. Plant-based foods on top of that for healthy options anyway is, you know, maybe even more. I'm not quite sure, but something that definitely really kind of bothers me about that element. I don't know whether you have a similar kind of thing.
I would agree with that. I think very often you can eat plant-based foods on a budget, but they're not always the options that are available to you are generally restricted if you're on a budget. And I'm also uncomfortable with judging people who are on a lower income and can't afford maybe to eat a fully plant-based diet. I think those of us who can, who have options, have a responsibility to choose wisely and to choose with compassion. But I think we also have to recognize that for some people, that's not their reality. They don't have those options.
But I think that's an issue even within an omnivore diet as well, isn't it? Because they're kind of doubly screwed in a way. You can't afford good quality meat and you can't afford good quality plant-based options. So, you know, we have a massive problem with factory farming. But one of the reasons why I think it is so big is because for a lot of the population, that's all they can afford. Yeah, I mean, maybe we don't want to turn this into a whole class thing. But yeah, you know, I definitely, yeah, it's something that I'm, you know, really passionate about and drives me crazy whenever I think about it, especially having come from the north as well, which I inject into conversation all the time with this. But it is so relevant as well, because there is a massive divide in the wealth between the two parts. And when I'm in London, you know, plant-based options are just, you know, they're everywhere. I can walk in anywhere and get a vegan version of everything. You can't get that in small towns in the north of England. It's a big problem.
Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about the last principle, which is citizenship. Tell me more about that. Is this idea of coming together, and how do we not create second-class citizens?
Yeah, for me, citizenship links in quite nicely, actually, into what Georgia was just saying. Individuals have the responsibility to make responsible choices, but we also need to create as a different system. And that requires cooperation and collective effort. It's not something that an individual can do by themselves. And it links to self-care as well, because putting that burden on yourself to try and eat in a way that is completely cruelty-free and has no kind of environmental problems whatsoever is extremely difficult. So for me, citizenship is about sharing with others what we learn and raising awareness about the issues. For me, it involved becoming involved in certain forms of activism, but it doesn't have to for everybody. It can just be kind of conversations that you have with family and friends, and also considering these issues when it comes time to vote for elected officials and if you see a petition, things like that. I think just being willing to talk with others and to try and work collaboratively to make a fairer and better food system.
Georgia, you said something in the webinar that really stuck with me. In fact, throughout the webinar, I wanted to stop you to talk a little bit more about it. You were talking about your wedding day. And this is the day you went vegan, right? This is the day you decided, yeah, I'm going to be vegan on my wedding day.
I made the decision to go vegan on my wedding day. But that was brought on by the fact that I'd wanted to go vegan for a couple of months before then. But I was still living at home. I mean, gosh, the whole sort of background to this, obviously, is that we were both raised Mormon and got married very young. It's not an uncommon thing in Mormonism. And so obviously that meant that I wasn't leaving home until I was married, aged 18. So I made the kind of pledge to myself, like a kind of commitment of, you know, the minute it becomes feasible for me to be a vegan, then I will do it. Because until that point, I was living at home and was, you know, really busy working and at school. And my mum was the one that was doing most of the food shopping. And I thought it would be unfair of me to expect her to not only buy all their food, but afford expensive and mock meats and stuff like this for me. So in my mind, I was like, you know, in order to combine my compassion and my kind of beliefs around this, I need to do it as soon as it is feasible for me to. And so in my mind, I was like, yeah, well, that's the day that I move out then. The day that I leave home is the day when I go vegan. And that just so happened to be my wedding day. So yeah, we got there and I just didn't eat any of the food. And I think that people were like, oh, she's just being, you know, a typical bride, like not wanting to eat much and everything in front of everyone. But no, there was just very little I could eat. I think I just ended up with a little bit of salad.
You said in the webinar that you had a lot of pride that day, though, and you and Ryan kind of were looking around with a little bit of disdain on everyone else. And this is where that phrase came that you said. You said you hadn't quite learned or understood about nuanced perspective in terms of what people eat. So tell us a little more about your journey to discovering nuanced perspective and how it's helped you maybe not have an attitude of, I'm better than you because I'm vegan.
Yeah. The nuanced perspective that I later developed was that I understood at last that it's not possible for everybody to be vegan. At that point, I was very much sold on the idea from like vegan activists that I mentioned, like Gary Yourofsky, that it's 100% possible for everyone. Like, you know, it's just, it's the healthiest thing. It's the best diet. Do it. No problems. No matter what you eat, you're going to be fine. And so with that idea in my mind, and then knowing about all the suffering that went into animal foods, I was just kind of like, well, why aren't you all going vegan? It's so easy. There's nothing at all to consider. Like, so that was kind of what I meant by disdain, was not so much for people as individuals, but more just to frustration of like, it's totally possible and fine to be vegan. Why aren't you all doing it already?
I think it goes back to this question of courage as well that we were talking about. You had already had that courage to give yourself a new identity, and you're probably asking, why can't everyone re-identify themselves as vegan?
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, it's a classic thing. I mean, a lot of people like to make out that, you know, it's just a vegan thing, that kind of attitude. And I'm like, no, it's the same no matter what. If you get a reformed alcoholic, a reformed smoker, a convert to a new religion, like literally anything, you will be so passionate about it in the beginning that you're going to want to tell everyone about it and you're going to think it's the greatest thing ever that you've discovered. And it's sort of no different with veganism. And what changed my mind on it was just growing up. Like, you know, there's no big secret towards developing more of that nuanced perspective. It's just a case of, you know, learning more that it's not possible health-wise for everyone, and that there are some people that maybe can't be 100% vegan, you know? And so because you then don't know everyone's individual situation, I can't then tell someone, you know, you need to go vegan. It's going to be the best thing for you because I just simply don't know. So I think the nuanced perspective came from just recognizing that I don't know everything. You know, I don't begrudge myself for having that, because I think if anyone says they haven't had a phase like that, you know, they're lying. Like, we've all done it as humans, especially when you're 18, you know, like it's everywhere. Everyone has a phase like that, I think. I think the context of my disdain in that moment came from a newly awakened realization of how much suffering humans have inflicted on animals. And when you first learn that, it's very difficult to remember to have compassion for the humans in those situations as well. Because, you know, you see people eating a steak and all I could see was a cow that was killed in a brutal way. And that was where it sort of came from.
And so as we gain more experience and more knowledge, we gain more perspective, those nuanced perspectives that you mentioned. Ryan, you mentioned that it took you about 2 years to move from simple meat reduction to vegetarianism. And then you said that it took 3 more years before you decided to become a vegan, or on your journey to becoming a vegan. Can you talk a little bit about some of the details of your transition? What were some of the key moments or learnings that helped bring you further on your journey to veganism and even animal activism?
Sure. So I was 14 when I saw the documentary that you mentioned earlier, Food Inc. And that opened my eyes first to some of the problems with corporate farming. I didn't go vegetarian then. I was put off fast food, especially sort of large fast food chains, because that documentary focused quite a little bit on those companies. So I stopped eating at places like McDonald's, KFC, places that I knew from that documentary were involved in stuff that just, it really put me off. I wasn't comfortable with it. And then it stayed in my mind, and I kept thinking about it, and the question that I kept coming back to was sort of, what gives me the right to take away an animal's life if I don't need to? And I didn't know very much about nutrition. I never really sort of studied anything like that growing up. And so the question that it raised in my mind was, well, I mean, do we actually need to eat meat to be healthy? Because that was kind of what I'd always believed growing up, was that you need in order to be healthy as part of a balanced. So I did some research, and also around that time I started speaking to Georgia, who had been studying a little bit about food and nutrition just as part of school and stuff. And we were talking, and I learned pretty quickly that meat is not a necessary part of a diet. You can get every single nutrient that the human body needs without meat. And so then to me, it seemed quite obvious. I was like, well, I mean, why on earth would I take away an animal's life if I don't need to for food? So I had that sort of inner realization, but then I was thinking, oh, I don't know if I can have the courage to take that step and to tell my family about that. At the time, I was living at home. It was a single parent family. We didn't have an awful lot of money. And I felt like it would be imposing an additional financial burden on my mum to kind of, you know, sort of cater for a special way of eating. But I still really had this feeling that I wanted to be vegetarian. And then when I was 16, I had kidney stones, which is very unusual for the age that I was. And I went to hospital, and the doctors informed me that one of the foods or food groups that can elevate your risk of kidney stones to a certain degree was meat and dairy and animal products. So to me, I was like, okay, well, this is my moment. This is the time when I can go vegetarian. And it was easier to explain to my family, because I had sort of two reasons. I was like, look, not only do I feel that this is unethical, but also it's possibly contributed to this health problem that I've been experiencing. So yeah, that was my journey to vegetarianism. Then over the next couple of years, I became more open and a bit stronger in my conviction that we didn't need to eat animals, and therefore it was wrong because it was unnecessary. I also began to learn more about the links between the dairy industry and the environment, and some of the environmental impacts of the dairy industry. And because I cared about the environment, I decided that I wanted to try and reduce my dairy consumption. And then it was actually Georgia who had quite a large impact on me finally making the decision to go fully vegan. So I watched the speech that she mentioned by Gary Yourofsky called The Greatest Speech You Will Ever Hear.
I was like, you need to watch the speech.
Yeah. So I watched that. I also watched a few other kind of documentaries and videos, did a little bit more research and learned more about what actually goes on, the abuse and the exploitation of cows and chickens in the dairy industry and the egg industry. And I decided that I could no longer really sort of support that in good conscience. So I decided to go vegan. And then this led to some sort of opposition from my family members, not huge, but they just kind of, you know, made fun of me a little bit and stuff. But in response to that sort of opposition, my views became stronger. And a couple of years later, we went on the official Animal Rights March in London, which was, looking back, that was sort of the start of me becoming more involved in vegan activism, because it was such a powerful experience to just be walking and marching with thousands of people who felt the same way. Before that, I'd always felt that kind of like a bit odd. Like nobody else really seemed to have a problem with animal agriculture or anything like that. And it always felt a bit like I was sort of the odd one out. Going on that march was a powerful experience. And then I became more involved in other forms of animal activism after that.
Thanks for sharing both of your journeys a little bit more about that. It gives me some insight. And I think our listeners will really enjoy hearing a little bit more about your personal convictions, but also some of the struggles and, you know, that being made fun of. It goes back to that courage question, because I do think that people take a lot of rap when they decide to make a change in their eating habits. So you were very clear, both of you, in your presentation that this is important to you politically, economically, socioculturally, and definitely environmentally. But Georgia, you just kind of talked about a conversion experience. You talked about this moment where things changed. And in the religious sphere, we talk about a metanoia, a conversion, this reorienting of ourselves that is often rooted in an identity of Christ. And I just want to ask, is there any type of spiritual or religious identity that has been important to you in terms of veganism or a journey towards veganism?
I think, you know, there definitely has been. For quite a while, I practiced witchcraft based off of my sort of experience with veganism, specifically, you know, Wicca. And the bit that drew me to that was there was a line from the Wiccan Reach, which was, "And it harm none, do what you will." And I love the fact that the whole sort of focus of that and the idea behind it was that, you know, whatever it is that you do, just make sure it's not harming someone. And that really resonated with me. You know, I think, yeah, that informed my decision to start practicing that for about a year and a half, I think. Yeah, about a year and a half. So that, you know, definitely has done in the past. I think I moved away from that after a while. You know, no major, that could be a whole other conversation in itself. These days, I don't know if I'd use the word spiritual, maybe kind of philosophical or moral, questions of ethics. I don't know, something like that. But I think definitely at different parts in my journey, it's had roots in spirituality. I mean, you know, being raised Mormon as well, obviously there was the element of the word of wisdom and reading in the Bible, like Genesis. I remember when we first got married, we had a big conversation about how we felt that the world was declared good by God when they were living in the garden, and if there was no kind of like bloodshed and things, would they have been eating animals? And, you know, like, so I think definitely in the past it's been informed by that for me. Would you agree with that? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. As Georgia said, throughout my childhood, I was a devout Mormon, the same as Georgia was throughout her childhood. And often after praying, especially I remember some experiences when I was living in Australia, I would pray about things. And then I remember opening my eyes after praying and I'd look out at the garden where we lived. And there, it was a beautiful garden and there were loads of birds that would be there and they would be singing. And I just remember several times after I would be praying, having this sort of distinct impression when I would open my eyes, that I just didn't want to cause any harm or suffering to these animals. And even more specifically, I remember thinking, I don't want to take away their life. And in fact, those experiences also laid the foundation for just my later convictions around peace and nonviolence more generally. So that they're very closely intertwined for me. Now my spiritual and religious beliefs have changed a lot, and they've changed several times in the intervening almost 10 years. And most of the specific kind of theology and worldviews that I had and was raised with has completely gone away. But I do think that some of the values that I approach food with could be seen as spiritual. I'd use the word spiritual to describe them. So I believe in the importance of mindfulness, of being aware of what we're eating. I believe that all lives are interconnected and that we have far more in common with other species of animals and other forms of life than we have differences. I believe that we share this world with other forms of life, that it doesn't just belong to us, that it's not exclusive to us. There's a quotation or a phrase that's sometimes used in the vegan movement, animals are here with us, not for us. And I do believe that. And I think when I try to live by those values, which I consider spiritual values, it leads me to look at what I'm eating and whether that aligns with those values and beliefs.
I really appreciate your honest responses here. You know, in Community of Christ, we have this church seal, which is a lion and a lamb and a child all kind of lying together and in the same picture, one not ravaging over the other. This comes out of Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9, where that talks about a lion and a bear and a cow, and they're all vegetarian. It says that they shall not hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain. And so for the restoration movement, Zion is this idea of returning to nonviolence in creation. And this may include our diets as well. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the spiritual and some of the theological implications of what's on our plate. And let's go to Doctrine and Covenants 86:2b, where it says, flesh also of beasts and of the fowls of the air, I, the Lord, hath ordained for the use of man with thanksgiving. Nevertheless, they are to be used sparingly, and it is pleasing unto me that they should not be used only in the times of winter or of cold or famine. It seems that these words of wisdom were helpful at the beginning of both of your journeys as you were both raised in the Mormon faith. Can you talk more about that influence? And was this part of your personal faith, or is it something that's taught a lot in the Mormon tradition?
I remember I took the word of wisdom very seriously in that regard. I remember getting into sort of like, you know, friendly conversation stroke arguments maybe about the word of wisdom, because it says, you know, except in, you know, times of famine. And I remember thinking like, but we're not in a time of famine. We live in the UK and we go and we buy our meat in plastic in a supermarket. Like this doesn't count as a time of famine or a time of need. And I remember thinking that quite strongly, even when I was, you know, younger, of like, you know, this doesn't make sense. I think mainly because the word of wisdom, especially those verses, was often used like against us by some, you know, Mormons at the time that would be like, oh, but Heavenly Father like ordained animals to be eaten by us. And we would always kind of be like, yeah, in times of famine, like, you know, that's not, you're not living like that now, you know, you're not, yeah. A favorite response I've heard by a vegan activist I like was that, yeah, you're not Bear Grylls out there hunting it yourself in the middle of like a desert, you know, you go down the supermarket and you buy bacon and you're making a sandwich, like, you know, it's not a survival instant. So I think it definitely had a big impact on me in that regard, definitely shaped my beliefs on that and kind of my understanding of when I would deem it necessary to eat meat and things.
Something that I find very interesting is that actually the warning against frequent meat eating in the Word of Wisdom is repeated twice, because it also then two verses later says, these hath God made for the use of man only in times of famine and excess of hunger. So it's repeated. And I just feel that I think partly it comes down to what we were saying at the beginning of the podcast about this tension between rules-based approaches versus principle-based approaches. And I think the Mormon approach to the word of wisdom, or at least the style of Mormonism that I was raised in and that I followed, was very rules-based. and liked very clear boundaries. And so people would, including myself when I was younger, would read the Word of Wisdom and say, oh, meat is not totally prohibited, therefore it's fine. But I think if we take a more principle-based reading of it, the emphasis, the overriding principle seems to be that these products should be limited to extreme or unusual circumstances. So it talks about famine, excess of hunger. It talks about winter, these times when there's not an abundance of plant food around. And that just doesn't apply to, well, certainly it doesn't apply to my life. I'm not saying there are definitely places in the world where people are living through famines and where they don't have choices. And I have no judgment at all for people in those situations. But certainly for me and for a lot of the people in our circles, they do have a choice. And I think the main kind of principle or emphasis in that section of the Doctrine and Covenants, as I read it, is that when we have those choices, we should choose to limit our meat consumption.
Interestingly as well, something that I would like to add, because it's just come back to me now, is that a couple of years actually, well after we'd left the church as well, quite a few people that we'd known as Mormons had actually gone plant-based, or like some of them even fully sort of vegan since what my old bishop did. Several other people as well, and one thing that was interesting is we've then heard them now when we've spoken to them since talking about the Word of Wisdom and saying how now they read it as a sort of a mandate, almost, maybe that's too strong of a word, but kind of like, a suggestion,
encouragement.
An encouragement, that's it. Yeah, benefit of being with a RE teacher for doing this, like an encouragement to sort of do it. And I just find that so interesting, because a lot of it is people that at one point were like, no, the Word of Wisdom means that we can eat meat. And, to be fair to Mormons, there does seem to be a much more kind of growing discussion about this topic in those communities as well, using the Word of Wisdom to have them, yeah.
Well, I see both of your journeys as a spiritual journey on its way to, veganism, but I also see it as a spiritual practice. I mean, it's, as you've said, you have to have self-care. There's daily practice that you have to do in living this type of lifestyle. Would you consider that to be true, is one of my questions. And then, are there other practices that go well along with this that help you on this question of what's on my plate? Are there other spiritual practices or practices that you're involved in or that you've heard of that are important to this question of nonviolence and what we eat?
I think there can be a close link between mindfulness, forms of mindfulness meditation, and food. I know that there's a very quite well-established, well-known practice of mindful eating where you focus on the experience of what you're eating. And I think that can be combined as well with awareness of what has gone into the food that you're eating as well. And I think that can take different forms for different people. I think for people who pray before their meal and say grace and things like that, I think that can be a wonderful opportunity to reflect on what's been involved in bringing the food to their table, and also to reflect on what we can do as individuals in our food choices to try and help move to a more peaceful and non-violent world.
I've actually noticed a big shift in some of the practice of prayer. So when I was younger, it seemed that the focus was on what a blessing, all of this abundance for us. And now when people pray, a lot of people spend a lot more time remembering who brought the food to our table, who actually cultivated that food and got it to our plates. And also people remember some of the abuses and things that are happening to workers that are helping to bring the food that's actually on our plate. So I know it's influenced even the practice of prayer that I practice and that other Christians around the world and other traditions as well practice.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.